All right, welcome to another episode of The Fifth Estate. I'm Jay Caruso, along with Neil Dewing. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well, Jay.
Yeah.
Not as well as you are, though. Congratulations. You were just in National Review online, so that's very nice.
Yep, got published in National Review. That was a lot of fun.
That's fun.
Yeah, so that's cool. Before we get started here, you know, we always say this at the beginning of every episode. If you like this show, please go out there, subscribe, tell your friends to subscribe, and leave us a rating. You know, open up iTunes, click on one of the, you know, click on the 5 stars. We like that, or just tell us how great you think the show is.
I will accept 4 stars as well, but we do appreciate the feedback, and we appreciate you spreading the word.
Always, always. Okay, so we are in the middle of a series we've been doing and having a lot of fun with it, talking to people that are in certain professions that, you know, from time to time, there's people that have negative opinions about them. And so we spoke with Ed Morrissey, who's a professional blogger. And then I just lost my train of thought. That's just like just a terrible, terrible thing to do. We spoke to the chief of Rob Atkerson, who's the chief of staff of for Barry Loudermilk, who's my congressman. Had a great conversation with him. And so this week we are, as we return back to the show, we grabbed a political consultant. So we wanted to do that, and he's been in this business for quite some time, and we're happy to have him here. Mr. Stuart Stevens, thank you for joining us.
Hey, listen, guys, great to be here.
All right. Well, we appreciate your time. We know that, you know, you're a busy guy. You not only do you do political consulting, you're a columnist for the Daily Beast, but you've been doing this for a while. Why don't let's start off with a little, you know, just give a little biography and you know, kind of how what got you started. What was like one of the first campaigns you worked on? How did you get into this business?
Yeah, I think political consulting is pretty much a profession of charlatans, and that's probably why I've always felt comfortable in it. I got started because I grew up in Mississippi, and at the time it was very much the sort of bad old days of Mississippi burning. And my family had been close to a guy named William Winter, who's a college friend of both my parents, who ran for governor. Really as a moderate on race, at a time when, that was a daring position to have. And it was incredibly exciting and dramatic and all those ways that, those in many ways tragic days were. And I can say that I worked in all of William Winter's campaigns, starting out like walking precincts, and eventually I would drive him. I worked in all of his losing campaigns, and finally I quit working for him, and he was able to get elected governor of Mississippi. He was a Democrat, of course, because we only had Democrats then.
Right.
But I have always sort of been interested in politics, film, and writing, and have tried to pursue those three with varying degrees of intensity and success. I worked in Thad Cochran's campaign when he ran for Senate in Mississippi. He was my congressman, and he was the first Republican elected since Reconstruction. Then I discovered that people would actually pay me money to make television commercials for him, and I could go and do it like migrant labor work, working campaigns, and then have time to try to write. No one would pay me to write in those days. So that's really how I entered this seedy profession.
So for you, it was also maybe something of a creative outlet. You know, you don't think of politics necessarily as a creative outlet very often, but gave you a chance to write and then do TV commercials.
It one of the things that I've always liked about it is the process of being in a campaign is so different than the process of writing, you know, which is very solitary by definition. I like being part of a larger group effort. And I have this deeply ingrained competitive streak, sort of obsessively so. And campaigns are a great outlet for that because you win and you lose. And one of the reasons I've never had particular interest in working in so-called Madison Avenue advertising, even though I think there's just unbelievably great work being done there, is the fact that it's scored so differently. I mean, if you're working for, say, Nike, and you want to up sales 50% of a certain product, and you do it 49.8%, you probably think that's pretty good. You know, in politics, you get 49.8%, you start jumping out of a window. Yeah. So that's been a balance. It's you know, as you go on in this business and you're fortunate enough to have success, and the secret of success as a political consultant is to work for people who are going to win anyway and just not screw it up. You start working in bigger campaigns, and, you know, that's happened with me. I've worked in the last, what, five presidentials, and there's really not an off season, which is something I miss.
Well, and I feel like we started preparing for 2016 almost as soon as 2012 was over, and I felt the same way as soon as 2008 was over, that we were already positioning and circling around for the next round, 4 years away. Is that kind of accurate? Do the moves start happening?
Yeah, I think so. And I think one of the sort of interesting, unfortunate aspects is that, you know, we spend 3.5 years studying sort of every blade of grass in a presidential election. And then we actually have an election. So we actually have this thing called data results. And most of us come to sort of instant conclusions about an election and then move on to the next election. One of the things I've done after 2012 is, fortunately, there's a handful of very smart political scientists in this country who actually study data called results. And certainly what I think about the 2012 election today is very different than what I thought on election day and in the immediate aftermath.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just, I think less, every election is a great lesson. And I think as a consultant, it's very difficult to even sit out a cycle, or you just lose something, an edge, touch, whatever it is. I know that if we had not done a lot of elections, by we, I mean my firm, had not done a lot of elections in 2010, I think we would have been lost doing all these Romney primaries, certainly in 2012. And if we hadn't done those, we would have been lost when we did, say, the Sad Cochran, Chris McDaniel primary in Mississippi, mm-hmm. in 2014. You just have to stay in the game.
Yeah, it helps you keep your edge.
Yeah, and you have to just go out and, you know, our goal has always been as a firm to do the biggest, toughest races in the country. We never try to do that many a year, but to really focus on them. We have not grown in size with a lot of partners or associates because, you know, our premise was we like doing this stuff. It's why we're doing it. If we like doing it, we think we're good at it. It's sort of counterproductive to go and bring in a whole bunch of people, mm-hmm. because then we'll end up managing people instead of running campaigns. But it's been a good model for us. You know, we now have a woman, Ashley O'Connor, who's managing partner. And the firm has grown. But it's really, I think, key to stay small and intense.
It's interesting. It's interesting. You know, one of the reasons that we wanted to talk to, you know, somebody, a political consultant, and I'm glad we got someone with your background, is after an election, you know, win or lose, people tend to have opinions about the performance of the consultant team. And I know that there's some tendencies on either side to fixate on operatives and communications, right, people and blame them for the loss. And actually, you wrote something in the Daily Beast, and it was part of an article about the Republican myth of the untapped white voter. But you wrote something at the very beginning of that piece that kind of laid out this situation, and I'll read just a brief portion of that. Information is consumed to confirm rather than inform opinions. And in the internet's endless feedback loop of misinformation, every hunch quickly escalates into an opinion hardened into a truth. If only Seattle had run against New England, they would have won the Super Bowl. And in politics, for many Republicans, the most unassailable truth is that winning the presidency is easy. If only And here, everyone finishes the sentence with their pet theory of electoral politics, which that is dead on. That is exactly what you see after a loss. And people tend to just blame the operatives. I think they fixate on that. So maybe, I don't know, what's your thought on that?
Well, you know, I think that when you lose an election, you can posit any theory you want that why you lost, and if only you had done X or Y, you would have won. Because there's no universe in which X or Y was done and didn't succeed, so mm-hmm. there's no control. You know, I went down to Austin in the spring of 99 to work on the Bush campaign. You know, I have deep respect for just how difficult it is for a Republican to win national election now. I did the Bush reelect. And as, you know, Carl and I have often said, you know, to each other and amongst our little group, you know, 75,000 Ohio voters had switched their votes in 2014. We would have been idiots. Mm-hmm. There is, I think, a reluctance in the Republican Party to admit how much the country has changed and what difficulties that presents for the party, as long as we're drawing upon the same base of support that we have been for the last few cycles. I mean, I just go back, Ronald Reagan won 57% of the white vote in 1980 and won a sweeping landslide of 44 states. Mitt Romney won 59% of the white vote and lost. If you take the same percentages of different demographics that Ronald Reagan got in 80 and apply it to the likely 2016 electorate, Reagan loses easily.
Yeah, and that's something that, you know, has really kind of come to light in the last year or so, as a lot of this data has been analyzed. One of the things that's, you know, sticks with me is that Democrats start with 240 electoral votes that they've consistently won over the last several decades.
243.
So they're in spitting distance already, and Republicans are at a major deficit.
No, I mean, we've in the last six elections, they've won states that every time that have come up to 243 electoral votes. Republicans have won states that have come up to 113 electoral votes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until you sit in these rooms and work these numbers, you just can't appreciate how difficult it is. If we're getting the same demographic groups. Now, I don't believe demographics are destiny, but they become destiny if you're getting a declining percentage of a growing segment of the electorate. And, you know, all of this, I think, was looked at after the 2012 election. And I think a lot of the conclusions of that so-called autopsy were true. And now, in this very human way, the party has done the exact opposite.
The exact opposite, yeah.
And, you know, seems headed to what is likely to be a historic defeat in a race that is, by every political science metric, a much easier race 2016 is than 2012.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You don't have an incumbent. You have a much weaker opponent who had a primary. And it's just a huge, I think, lost opportunity that we're going through.
Indeed. I agree completely. And I don't know if you're familiar, a writer named Tom Nichols. He writes over The Federalist. He has this theory, and he's writing a book about it. I think he's written it. It's called The Death of Expertise. And I think that sort of encompasses a lot of what we're seeing this year especially, but in previous elections as well. And it's this active scorn for people who actually have experience and knowledge and have worked in situations like running a political campaign and doing that sort of thing. Just a rejection of that and replacing it with their gut feeling.
It's look, I mean, people say, oh, well, you know, Mitt Romney was a terrible candidate, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. On Election Day, Mitt Romney's favorable, unfavorable was 50-47 for +3. Donald Trump today is at -28. Mitt Romney raised over $1 billion. You have Donald Trump has raised $55 million. So it's just willful nonsense. And it's predicated upon an unwillingness to admit that the way you see the world is not how the world is. And, you know, one thing about politics and working as a political consultant, I'm often accused of not really believing anything but winning, which I always found odd because that's the only reason anybody hires me is to help them win.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not there to remind people of their deeply held beliefs. And, you know, that's something in this book I just wrote, Innocent of Nothing to Fear, I kind of wanted to get into of sort of what it's like to be a political consultant in relationships with within the campaign and with candidates.
Oh, that's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, you were there for one purpose. You're a hammer and you're not supposed to go out and get famous as a hammer. You're just supposed to be like a good hammer. Now, you know, we've been very lucky. We have my firm and we've worked for more, helped elect more Republican senators and governors than any other firm and both Bush campaigns. And we won every race that we did in 2014, five governor's races, including in Maryland. Larry Hogan, probably the toughest.
Which was a tough one.
Yeah, they're all tough. But you have to approach a presidential race. I've always said this, you know, you can enter a presidential race humbly or not, but you're going to leave it humbled. And win or lose, and I've done both. The process doesn't care about you. The process is the process. And, you know, you see Donald Trump complaining about how he's getting bad press and no one gives him a fair. You know, it's like some rookie riding his girlfriend in an NFL camp saying, they're big and they're strong and they're trying to hit me. You know, it's like, that's right, dude. Welcome to the NFL. And it really, I think, is something probably has to play itself out. I think a lot of people ran for president and a lot of people were involved in presidential campaigns in this last cycle who did not have an appreciation for how difficult it was to win. And a lot of people found that out. You know, Governor Walker was critical of Mitt Romney. He didn't last 80 days. And I think a lot of people inside these campaigns thought it was a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
It is very, very difficult. I think Donald Trump should have been a very easy candidate to defeat. But for a series of reasons, no one really tried to defeat him for a long time. But it's what you learn if you do this. Now, in theory, I think, you know, the party's going to lose this November, which almost, you know, 9 times out of 10, you run this race, Donald Trump loses. It should be a learning experience. I'm not convinced that parties, Democrat or Republican, are learning organisms. But I think a lot of pet theories are going to be tried and walked around, and they already are. And we'll see how well they work.
Well, here's the question, Stuart. How much influence do people like you, who've been around this business for a while, have, you know, within the party itself and the leaders to sit there and say, guys, we have to start doing something different? You know, all you're doing really is just you haven't changed anything. You're just kind of polishing stuff. And
I don't think we have any influence. I mean, if you look at the Trump campaign, they've basically reassembled the Dole campaign.
Right. And I mean, and that's the kind of thing that's crazy because, you know,
in the Dole campaign. I did the primary for Dole, and then we weren't really fired, but we kind of got pushed aside.
Right. Well, that's kind of like what happened with Scott Walker. He had all those people within his who helped him win two elections in the state. And when he decided to run for president, it was like all those people got kind of pushed out for a bunch of people who were national thing. It was kind of different, though. I mean, I don't know really how that works and if that is the typical way that that kind of thing works.
I mean, I think you just have to approach running for president with great, great fierceness, but great humility. You have to respect the process. And you have to realize your own weaknesses going into a primary, and not kid yourself. There's no kidding the numbers. And just how much work it is. And that's something that Mitt Romney was really, you know, he's very good at a lot of things, but two things in particular. One, he's very self-critical, and he learns from experience. It's one of the reasons he's been successful at pretty much everything he's ever done in his life. He's very humble about that. I mean, after a debate, he's the kind of guy, you know, unlike any other candidate I've really known, who wants to talk about what he did wrong. You know, most, you know. And two, he really works like a dog. His work ethic is tremendous. And one of the things you're seeing in the Trump campaign is Trump is just lazy. He sits around mostly and watches TV and tries to find somebody on television who's not saying something nice about him. And that's why he's not raising any money, which is a disaster for these victory committees in these states.
Well, he's on record now saying that, you know, even if Republicans lose Congress, he's okay with that. So that's got to make Paul Ryan feel great.
I don't know. I've tried not to be critical of anybody who disagrees with me on Trump. I could be wrong about Trump. But I think one of the reasons I've tried to do that is it's such a Trump-like thing to criticize anybody who doesn't agree with you that I think it's particularly important now not to fall into that trap. And I have a lot of friends who are for Donald Trump, and I don't think they're bad people or dumb or crazy. We just have a difference of opinion. But whether or not Donald Trump should be president or not, and I think he's uniquely unqualified to be president, he's a historic disaster as a candidate. And, you know, you see this, to go to your point about the death of expertise, you see people who'll say, well, you know, it's great to see a candidate who just fights with the media, tells them where to get off, and thank God we're doing that. I think, yeah, how's that working? You know? I mean, 70% of the country has an unfavorable view of Donald Trump. And, you know, it's sort of like cold fusion. Great. Heat, you know, light without heat. That's tremendous. But, like, does it work? Can you replicate it? And, you know, I think it's just a tragedy for the party that Trump is sort of the embodiment of a lot of these nutty, demonstrably untrue theories.
Yeah, it's amazing to see, you know, everything that he said and everything that he's done. I guess you have the people like you talked about, you know, because I know there are people that I know that are gonna vote for Trump, and I try to kind of keep that in mind, you know, when I'm sitting there getting hate tweets from white nationalists about it. But I mean, you know, it's amazing to see, especially the hardcore supporters who will just defend anything that he says or anything that he does, and it's just kind of like I tell people it reminds me of 2008 and Barack Obama. It didn't matter what it was. And some people have said to me openly, I don't care. You know, it's just, he's not the establishment. So that's all that's good for me. He's a businessman. And we need somebody who runs a business to do that. I'm like, well, we had that in 2012, you know.
But of course, you know, with Trump, he is the ultimate establishment figure. If inherited wealth on Fifth Avenue is not the American establishment.
I don't
know what is. He's the quintessential establishment. This isn't some prairie populist. you know, they rose up like El Cid out of the Arizona desert to come sweep across America. You know, he's a guy who inherited a bunch of money and a business. And has pretty much just stayed in that business. That's the only one he's ever been successful is the one that his father started. That's, you know, that's great American establishment tradition.
Exactly.
And it's sort of like political correctness. Political correctness is not a synonym for stupidity. In many ways, it's a synonym for civility. I mean, you don't call Mexicans, you know, our largest neighbor, you don't call them rapist. You don't. I mean, there are a number of sort of unspoken compacts that govern civil society, and America's been very good at that. You know, we've never gone to a strong man when other countries in the 30s across Europe, there was sort of fell to that siren's call. And, you know, Trump seems to be someone who is testing that. And it's, you know, he's now getting 0% of African-American votes. So if you just pause right there. Before 1964, Republicans got 30 to 35% of African-Americans. Not great, but not catastrophic. If you're at 35, maybe you can claw your way up to 45. If you're 45, maybe you can get to 50. But after 64, it fell off a cliff. We now have a presidential nominee who in major latest polls in major swing states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, he's getting zero support from Americans. They can't even find somebody who supports him. So, you know, in the Bush campaign in 2004, you know, President Bush was able to get, what, around 41% of Hispanics. It started to decline in 2011. A generic Republican was getting 27% of Hispanics. Mitt Romney got 27% of Hispanics. The primary didn't hurt Mitt Romney. The primary didn't help him with Hispanics. But if what happens with African Americans in 64 happens with Hispanics in 2016, there won't be another Republican president elected for generations. I mean, it's just a fact. And I fear that that is happening now.
That's a fear I share with you. And, it's kind of mind blowing when you think about, you know, you just look at the numbers, you look at what's going on, and you can't really argue with a lot of that.
No, I think you can debate whether or not there is a moral imperative that a political party represent a broader slice of America.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue there is. And I would argue that if you look at our successful governors, like Larry Hogan, like Charlie Baker, Asa Hutchinson, these are people who actively seek the support of those who are not exactly like them. But you can't argue about the political imperative in just an election sense of having to represent more of the country. It's just math. You can't get there. So people say, well, you know, not every white voter voted for Mitt Romney. Yeah, you're right. But it's sort of like you got a baseball team, you got one 450 hitter and a bunch of 125 hitters, and you say, well, we want to raise the average. Can't we get the 450 hitter to hit 650? Possible. But wouldn't it be better maybe to get these 125 guys to hit the
Well, that's a good question that you bring up, because if you look at Republican success at the state level,
yeah,
the number of governorships we have, the number of state houses that we have, how come there's such a difficulty in translating that into the national?
Well, there's two reasons. One is the electorate is different by about a third. About a third more people vote in presidential years than in non-presidential years. That is a unpleasant truth, as our friend Al Gore would say, or awkward truth. Because you'd like to be in a world always where more people vote, you do better. You don't want to be losing $5 on every sale and trying to make it up in volume. The other thing is that I think a lot of these governors have been, in particular, have been more successful at establishing their own message. So, you know, the classic example is in Texas, how Texas treated Hispanics. So you go back to 1994, there's the Pete Wilson approach, which I think, you know, Governor Wilson gets blamed for this too much. It's larger forces at work. But, you know, he made the famous, you know, they're coming over the border spot. They keep coming. Versus what Governor Bush did in his election against Ann Richards, where he actively courted Hispanics. So what has happened since 1994? Republicans can't get elected in Texas. I mean, can't get elected in California. And Democrats can't get elected in Texas. So there's sort of like a clear path there. If you want to win, you should do the Texas model. And come to grips with that. And others have as well. And it's when you have a national party that is being branded by, you know, an intemperate guy like Donald Trump, it's terrible for the whole party. I have a friend, he's a doctor. He works, he says, you know, in our hospital, it's about 30%. Hispanic or Asian, I work with.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, explain to me, call me up. He says, so you're supposed to be good at this stuff. Explain to me what I'm supposed to say. Like, give me some talking points, you guys call them, right? When a Hispanic coworker of mine, to explain to him that Donald Trump didn't mean that all Hispanics were rapists. Like, you got anything for that? I go, no, man. I'm not that good. I don't know. Because he said, I don't think I could put a Trump bumper sticker and park it in our parking lot.
But Stuart, he tweeted out a picture of him eating a taco bowl.
Yes. No, it's it's just I don't see how the Onion can survive this. And look, I you're going to have good polls and bad polls, but, you know, it's very difficult to get Donald Trump over 40%. Hmm. I mean, Hillary Clinton is a disaster. You know, PJ O'Rourke says, you know, she's horrible, but horrible within the normal parameters, where Donald Trump is a flying monkey.
Well, the New York Times poll just came out. I mean, it's like, you know, it normally, like, obviously she was hurt by the email thing, and you know, but the poll came out and they're both at 40%. It's like, you know, yeah, Hillary sunk, but Trump didn't rise.
The difference is, look, Donald Trump against Hillary Clinton is kind of like, you know, Slippery Rock playing Alabama. They might have a couple of good quarters in them, but by the fourth quarter, the weight of the mass is going to grind them down.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing pushing Donald Trump up. He's running. He thinks he's running against Hillary Clinton, but he's running against Donald Trump. When you have 30-35% favorable, you just can't expand. 65-70% of the country doesn't like you. It's like a restaurant that's getting terrible online reviews. You're not going to grow. Sure, you got a base of customers. They like to come. They, you know, maybe they got engaged there. They come back. They don't really care. You know him personally. You're not going to grow, though, if everybody, you know, checks out that restaurant and goes, well, it's terrible. And that's the problem Trump has. Plus, Democratic Party is about 10 points more favorable than the Republican now. So you don't have anything lifting you up in that category. So it's until Donald Trump can rehab his own image, he's not really in it. Because, look, we got basically four groups of voters, right? We got male, female, white, non-white. That's it. That's all we got. So which one of these is Donald Trump going to do better with than Mitt Romney did? And which one of these is Hillary Clinton going to do worse with than Barack Obama? I mean, Mitt Romney won white women by 14 points. Donald Trump is, what, tied or losing? And 14 points wasn't enough, by the way, you know. There's some truth to
this.
No, rumor that Mitt Romney lost. But, you know, we talk about gender gap and we talk about, say, youth vote. Well, Mitt Romney won voters under 30 if you were white. So it's not really about age or sex. It's about ethnicity. That's the denominator. So maybe, you know, Donald Trump does a little better with white men than Mitt Romney. But Romney got 62% of white males with high school or less education. 62. So maybe you bang that up to 65.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. But what do you do about, like, you know, there's some unfortunate amendments there that he wouldn't like if he knew what they were that let women vote. So now we're losing white women. You can't get there from here.
I also heard that he was down with college-educated white men,
which is the GOP. Yeah,
if I'm not mistaken, yeah, Republicans have never lost college-educated white men. And no, he's down.
We've never lost it. Look, in the 2004 campaign, you know, we discovered, kind of to our dismay, but then we adapted, that there really were no persuadable voters. You know, we would make these spots. I remember we made some about women voting for the first time in Afghanistan and going to school. And we'd show them the people in focus groups who were not for George Bush, but could be for George Bush, we thought. And people literally would cry. I can remember people saying, that's the best spot I've ever seen in my life. But, okay, will you vote for him? Not in a million years. Are you crazy? You know, we'd show them stats that said, you know, George Bush increased federal spending for education with No Child Left Behind by record amounts. I go, I don't believe it. Look, it's in the New York Times. I go, you made that up at Kinko's. So,
that's exactly the rejection that Tom Nichols talks about in this Death of Expertise. You can present with evidence.
So what did we do? I mean, you had to go and get people who would have voted for George Bush in 2000 who didn't vote for George Bush. So, you know, and really Carl was the genius behind this, and Carl really is a genius, of fortress precincts. Precincts where we got 60% before, now we got to get 63. Where we got 63% before, we got to bang that up 66. And there was a massive campaign on every level, from messaging to organization, that delivered that. But it was very, very hard and very close. So, you know, I was doing Mel Martinez in 2004, and I was doing George Bush. Mel Martinez running open Senate seat in Florida. I mean, Mel was a good candidate. We ran a good campaign, not fabulous, but good. And Mel won. But I can promise you Mel wouldn't have won if George Bush wasn't winning Florida. And if you look at 2012, there's only one Senate race, the Republicans, there was any kind of race, Republicans won in a state that Romney lost. That was Heller in Nevada, and he won by 0.03 in a three-way. So it's hard. It is very, very hard to overperform the top of the ticket. And, you know, that's one of the looming tragedies if, you know, next week we actually nominate Donald Trump, which I guess we're going to do.
Yeah, unfortunately. I'll say that. So let's shift gears a little bit.
Yeah.
Stuart, and why don't you tell us about, you know, I wanted to ask you a personal question, though, first, if you're okay with that. I've seen you tweet quite often about your dad.
Yes.
98 years old.
98, yes.
And he's still kicking. Tell us, you obviously, from what you said about it, from what I could see, he's had a big impact on your life. You know, kind of,
you know,
what did he instill in you that other people look forward and look to in their fathers?
You know, I've been incredibly lucky in life in every respect. I mean, and a lot of it is just sheer luck. You know, both my parents are they're both still alive. My dad's 98, my mother's 89 now. You know, we're people who passed the Gore Vidal test, and the Gore Vidal says to be interesting, you have to be interested. And they were very interested people. And my father's one of these classic greatest generation stories. I mean, he grew up in Mississippi. I mean, I'm a seventh generation Mississippian. He was six. Went to law school, then went into the FBI. Had a lot of friends that were getting killed and shot up in the war. He was stationed in New York City. And then he entered the Navy because he really felt it was his duty. And had, you know, three years in the South Pacific, 28 landings. And came back and started a law firm with his high school, college roommate, you know, that now is biggest firm in the state, one of the biggest firms in the South. And he, you know, he was someone that when you had race as we did in the era when I was growing up, is such a dramatic part of one's life. You know, my father never, and my mother both, never found a comfortableness with what was clearly wrong with Mississippi. They never tried to rationalize it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to say they were civil rights, you know, heroes or heroines, but, you know, as a kid, I really saw them struggling with it. And that it was a fascinating sort of moral landmine, and to see parents and people you love struggling with that. And I think it's really been a great gift to me. So, you know, after the 2012 campaign, my dad turned 95 in December, right after the November election. And one of the things that we had found that we loved to do when I was growing up was go to football games, college football games together, particularly Ole Miss football games. So that fall of 2013, he and I and my mom, we went to all the Ole Miss games together. And that formed the sort of spine of this book, The Last Season.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot about reflecting on growing up in the South and my parents. Mississippi is an incredibly complicated, in many ways, troubled state, but it's a fascinating state, sort of the Ireland of America, you know, where this green place where we probably drink and fight too much and love music too much and love art. I've got to give, you know, Mississippi a lot of credit. And there really has been efforts, particularly places like the University of Mississippi, which, you know, Mississippi is probably the most southern state and Ole Miss is probably the most southern university, to really confront the past and confront the present as regards race. And it's not that it's perfect now, but at least there's been a struggle. And you have good days and bad days and four steps backwards and hopefully four and a half forward. But there's not a denial about it, I don't think. And I find, you know, as someone who's lived my adult life largely outside the South, that it's often more convenient to deny it than not.
I think you see that general tendency a lot now, to just sort of look away rather than confront the issue head on. But The Last Season sounds like a wonderful book. And actually, reading the synopsis of your latest book, which is called The Innocent Have Nothing to Fear, I'm thinking as soon as we're done, I might have to hop on Amazon here because it's got this great premise. And would you mind running us through that real quick?
No, I've long been fascinated. I'm not sure why, but as a political junkie by contested conventions. When I was in film school, I wrote what I'm sure was a horrible script about the 1928 Democratic Convention. So, you know, I started this book before the Romney campaign and long before Donald Trump emerged. But you could see in the sort of Teutonic plates of our politics how a strong man could emerge. So after the Romney campaign, I wrote this book about my father, and then I went back to this book. And it's set in the near future, at a Republican convention set in New Orleans, which I think, just as the Olympics should always be held in the same place, I think all conventions, Democrat and Republican, should be held in New Orleans every 4 years. It's best suited to the essential quality of a convention, which is to get drunk and have fun. So the narrator of it is from New Orleans, and he is working for a Republican sitting vice president who represents sort of a more establishment candidate, running against a Colorado governor who is a true populist, unlike Donald Trump, but who is for strong anti-immigration, a new Bill of Rights, these sort of sweeping draconian changes. Now, I posited the book after an economic crash because I thought that it was really important that there'd be a triggering mechanism so that what was happening would seem more believable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a dark comic novel, and I think part of the humor is to believe that it could happen. But as it turns out, with Donald Trump, you didn't really need a triggering.
I was going to ask when you wrote it, because it's really... It's very eerie how accurate. I was going to say, did you write this last month, maybe?
Yeah, no. Listen, if I'd known it might come true, I would have been more careful. and I'm writing a book now, let me just warn you, about a second American Civil War.
So oh, no.
Oh, jeez.
I think that... You see this in the Sanders campaign, you see it in the Trump campaign, that there are a lot of people since the particularly after the 2008 crash and economic crisis, who feel that there are these large, powerful forces in their life that they have no control over.
Mm-hmm.
And that they have to react to these forces without having any ability to seek favor or to avoid pain.
Right.
And, you know, in previous points in American history, like in the late 1800s when you saw this, we had a lot of big religious movements. And if you go to a Bernie Sanders rally, and I've been to a lot of them, and if you go to a Donald Trump rally, and I've been to a lot of them, you know, everyone there pretty much is economically stressed. At least they feel that they are. You see very different reactions to it. But I think that sense that there's some sort of shredding of the American compact between citizens and a government that we've always counted on, which is, you know, next generation will be better off, you work hard, you can get ahead. That bargain is sort of being challenged. Sanders reacts one way, Trump reacts in another. But it's, in many ways, you know, I think the last 7 years, there's been sort of a conspiracy of silence about how bad things really are for most people. And I attribute that, you know, for better or worse, and it's more worse than better. You know, I think center left has been better about talking about those who are left behind than center right. It's just not in our vocabulary as well. And there's been sort of a conspiracy of silence on the center left about how bad things are the last 7 years because they don't want to undermine the president and they don't want to help Republicans. So, you know, you don't have a normal discussion about the fact that, you know, the rich have gotten much richer. The middle class now is the smallest of the three classes, poor and rich, middle class. Middle class has shrunk. You have, you know, 25% increase in child poverty. It's just a lot more desperate people out there. And it's not being discussed. I mean, we don't have a Studs Terkel or John Steinbeck now. We have John Stewart, who, you know, multimillionaire suburban guy from New Jersey. He's a social critic, but he's not someone who speaks to kind of that larger pain.
Right.
And I think it's something really missing in our public dialogue.
I think you're right about that. And I think that when we do actually make an attempt to discuss it, people fall back on their easy formulations, you know, saying this would be fine if only we'd, and then they fill in the blank with whatever their preference happens to be. And that's not critical thought. That's not really examining the issues. And that doesn't leave much room for actual solutions, which may not exactly conform to our ideological preferences.
No, that's very true. I mean, one thing to say about Bernie Sanders, you have to give him credit, you know. I mean, the guy has a organized view of the world. I think he's dead wrong.
Yeah.
But he's been dead wrong for 40 years. I mean, I went to Middlebury College in Vermont, and I can remember when he was running for mayor, and, you know, he was basically saying the same thing he is now. He won that election by 10 votes. People couldn't believe it. and, you know, now he's the most popular politician in the national scene by fave, unfave. I mean, he has the largest donors. I mean, it's incredible. You know, I think that there's been sort of a assumption among many, you guys would see this or not, but among many conservatives, or sort of center-right, that Barack Obama was an ideological exception. That because after the Bush years and the fatigue of the wars and the economic crash, you had this, you know, incredibly charismatic, positive character emerge on the national scene, Barack Obama, and the country was willing to vote for him even though they weren't as left as he was. And that after Barack Obama, we would more revert to a center-right sort of base. I kind of always thought that. But, you know, the data doesn't really lead us there. You have to look at Bernie Sanders, and, I mean, they're basically running against the Democratic Party in 1992. I mean, Hillary Clinton's basically running against Bill Clinton. And, you know, it may be, I mean, I wrote a piece about this for the New York Times. It may be that the country, that premise was wrong and that the country's resetting to more left. And that's kind of fascinating.
I've had the same thought. And I think it's much more comfortable to cling to the idea that maybe there's just this slumbering majority of center-right people out there that are going to rise up and reclaim, you know, the American constitutional order, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not likely to happen. And I don't, and I think, like you said, the numbers don't really support that.
We're ending this show on a high note, I'll tell you.
Kind of.
such a positive. I don't know, you know, guys, I look at just stuff like trade with Donald Trump, right? I mean, a Republican is the first candidate to run against NAFTA and he swore 45% tariff. I mean, madness. Utter, stark, raving madness. And like a Muslim ban.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
How are you going to institute a Muslim ban? So Cat Stevens shows up in Heathrow and says, you know, I'm not a Muslim anymore. I'm a Quaker. What are you going to, like, ask him like trivia questions about William Penn? I mean, I talk to Quakers. I have friends who are Quakers. I talk to them like all night. I still don't get it. I mean, so what? How are you going to know? I mean, it's the most lunatic. It's a religious test to enter the United States.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing with saying he's going to get Mexico to pay for the wall. I mean, how do you get it? How do you get a sovereign nation to pay for something that you're building?
It's absurd. First of all, you know, there's not many Mexican Muslims. There are a lot of American Muslims. So he should be trying to get more Mexicans in because, you know, that'll be good. And if we're going to ban countries, you know, with Muslim Americans who have, you know, experienced terrorism, then probably Mexico's going to ban Americans. Like, why? You know, why should
we let exactly.
I mean, that's how trade wars work. You know, you raise a tariff, they raise a tariff, and it progresses along.
What's a 45% tariff on China? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, how hard is that to run against? You have a Trump tax.
Exactly.
So that Camry you're going to buy, you really want it to be 45% more?
Yeah. I mean, I was just looking like the other day, it was like, you know, Amazon had their Prime Day and they had like a 55-inch curved television for like $550, you know, and that kind of technology when it first came out, you know, plasma televisions were $10,000 and now almost anybody can buy one. But you're right. Do you want the price of that thing to be 45% higher? It'll make you feel better.
It's, you know, you want to walk into Walmart and everything's like, you know, 80% of it's 45% more.
Yeah, those rollbacks aren't going to help at that point.
I, It's just, you know, look, the two largest Muslim countries are Indonesia and India. So we're going to ban Indians? So, like, if Bobby Jindal gets appointed to the Supreme Court and his family, who are Hindu, want to come from India, they're going to have to prove they're Hindus and not Muslims?
Right.
I mean, it's just...
Yeah.
It's catastrophically stupid. And it's also very un-American. And I, what I'm really disappointed in is the party not challenging that more. And I think it's going to be a heavy price to pay for it.
I agree. I agree. You're ending on a kind of sour note, but you're right, because they should have fought this a little bit more. But that's a fight we'll take up for another day.
Well, we don't necessarily have to end on a down note.
No. We don't have to do that.
We have one more question, which could make either Jay or myself very happy.
Yeah, this is the only time of the show that we put our guests on the spot. This is the one time we're going to put you on the spot. As you can hear, Frank Sinatra is playing in the background. We've had this thing going on. We've done this on every episode, where we ask our guests. You know, Neil is a Dean Martin fan. I am a Frank Sinatra fan. And so basically what we do is we sit there and say to our guests, okay, now it is your turn to choose. If you were going to pick one or the other, would it be Dean Martin or would it be Frank Sinatra?
Oh, Frank Sinatra.
Ah!
Well,
yeah. I mean, complicated, wonderful character.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So I would do it for the person. You know, I wrote this... I sold this TV show to HBO set in Georgetown during the Kennedy years.
Uh-huh.
Basically Pamela Harriman's salon. And in it, you start diving down into that research, which I did, which was great fun. You really see the Sinatra influence on Kennedy. And it's just absolutely, those intertwinings, absolutely fascinating.
That is an interesting hook, and I'll admit, you know, 60s Sinatra is pretty cool. I'm more of a laid back kind of guy, so I go Dino.
He goes Dino.
I loved your intro music.
Oh yeah, Charlie Parker.
Fantastic.
Yeah. All right. Well, Stuart Stevens.
All right.
Yes. Thank you very much for being on with us. We appreciate your time. To our listeners out there, go out and. Pick up a copy of The Last Season or The Innocent Have Nothing to Fear, two excellent books, sounds like, by Stuart Stevens.
Yeah, you're great storytellers, Stuart. I'd like to have you back at some point.
Love to do it, guys. I really enjoy it.
Sounds okay. Great. All right, guys. Everyone, we will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate. Do not miss it.